This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Top stories. Russia's chief negotiator in talks with Ukraine says discussions on a deal over the neutrality and non-nuclear status of Kiev are now at a practical stage. Palestinian resistance groups hail an anti-Israeli operation in a Tel Aviv suburb, calling it a legitimate response to crimes against Palestinians. Also ahead, Iran says Afghanistan deserves more international attention as China hosts a meeting of Afghan neighbors. Welcome to the program. The latest round of negotiations between Russia and Ukraine in Istanbul shows signs of progress. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says the signals coming from the talks could be positive, but Zelensky still sees no reason to believe comments made by certain Russian representatives. He says Ukraine can only rely on a concrete outcome of the talks. This after Russia's chief negotiator said discussions on preparing a deal on the neutrality and non-nuclear status of Ukraine are now at a practical stage. Alexander Fomin said Russia would now radically ramp down military activities near Kyiv and the northern city of Chernihiv. Elsewhere, Turkey's foreign minister says his Russian and Ukrainian counterparts are now expected to meet after the two sides reached a common understanding in the Tuesday talks. Meanwhile, Washington says the West would like to see if Russia will de-escalate its operation.
Peace will have no losers, and a prolonged conflict is not in anyone's interest. This is how Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan opened the face-to-face Russian-Ukrainian negotiations in Istanbul on Tuesday. Erdogan sounded optimistic as he assured Turkey's readiness to host a meeting between the Russian and Ukrainian presidents, whom both he referred to as valuable friends. A Ukrainian negotiator told reporters that they made a series of proposals during the talks to the Russian delegation, which included a demand from Ukraine to have 8 countries as guarantors, including Turkey. While Ukraine can guarantee not having foreign military bases, meaning it would not join military alliances. Ukraine's proposal also includes a 15-year consultation period on the status of annexed Crimea. However, it could only come into force in case of a complete ceasefire.
Ukraine wants to see 8 countries, including Turkey, the US, the UK, France and Germany, as guarantor states to legally actively protect Ukraine from any aggression.
Meanwhile, the Russian negotiator said they will convey Ukraine's suggestions to the Russian president, while describing the talks as constructive. Medinsky later said during the talks with the Ukrainian delegation that Russia is not against Ukraine joining the EU. The Russian delegation said a meeting between Putin and Zelensky would only be possible if a deal was sealed by foreign ministers of the two countries.
Expect a ceasefire upon these meetings, negotiations, within days, maybe through this week, through the end of this week. But this might be a limited ceasefire. I mean, the Donbas region may be out of ceasefire, but at least there will be a positive step through ceasefire. The peace agreement will take some time. The questions are, problems are very big. Donbas and Crimea are something the leaders needed to discuss and agree.
The Russian delegation said a meeting between Putin and Zelensky would only be possible if a deal was sealed by the foreign ministers of the two countries. Meanwhile, the Russian Defense Ministry announced a suspension of all operations around Kiev and Chernihiv after the meeting. Today's meeting was considered constructive, as it will pave the way for deeper negotiations between the foreign ministers of Ukraine and Russia, and hopefully reaching an agreement on a complete ceasefire. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Russia's defense minister says Moscow is now focusing on the liberation of Ukraine's Donbas region as Ukraine's military capacity has been seriously degraded.
The main objectives of the first phase of the operation have largely been achieved. Combat potential of the Ukrainian armed forces has been substantially degraded, thus allowing us to focus our main attention and main efforts on achieving the primary goal of liberating Donbas.
Speaking to officials in a televised meeting, Sergei Shoigu said Russia is monitoring statements by the NATO countries that are after supplying aircraft and air defense systems to Ukraine. He warned that Moscow would respond appropriately if NATO goes ahead with its decision to give more backing to Kyiv. Shoigu also cautioned that a Western supply of lethal weapons to Ukraine may backfire on the Europeans themselves.
We consider the position of the West, which supplies lethal weapons to Ukraine, to be irresponsible. Its uncontrolled distribution to the population and mercenaries only exacerbates and may create a threat to the Europeans themselves.
Russia says its cruise missiles destroyed a fuel depot in western Ukraine. According to Ukrainian sources, a Russian rocket hit an administration building in the south, killing 12 people. Meanwhile, Russian media say a military camp of the Russian forces that is near Ukraine's border has been shelled. Elsewhere, France says, given the circumstances, a humanitarian operation in Ukraine's besieged city of Mariupol remains unlikely. This after a phone conversation between President Emmanuel Macron and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin, where the Russian leader said the Ukrainian nationalists of the city must first lay down their arms to resolve the difficult humanitarian situation. And now a little more than a month has passed since the beginning of the Russian offensive against Ukraine. According to the Russian leadership, the main goal at the initial stage is almost fulfilled. Our correspondent Marina Kurtunova has visited the frontline territory and filed a report for us.
For 8 years, Donbas, a region of eastern Ukraine that did not accept the results of the Kyiv coup in 2014, has been under frequent shelling from national battalions and the armed forces of Ukraine. Residents of Donbas called it a war crime against the people, and from that moment Ukraine ceased to be a state in their eyes. According to Russian investigators, the actions of the Ukrainian military led to the deaths of more than 2,600 civilians, while more than 5,500 people were injured. 2,200 civilian infrastructure facilities were destroyed.
This is a town, a school, number 50 of the sadly known town of Gorlovka in the Donbas region, which is being shelled regularly.
The last time it was shelled by Ukrainian artillery on 24th of February, the teachers died on the spot. But one of the heaviest recent shellings, hushed up by the Western media, happened on March 14 in Donetsk. The Ukrainian military hit the center of the city with a Tochka-U tactical missile equipped with a cluster warhead. The rocket was shot down, but due to the fall of debris, 23 people died and 18 were injured.
The special operation of Russia is our opportunity to defend ourselves. The possibility that the Donbas will not be destroyed and hundreds of thousands of civilians will not be lost due to the Ukrainian aggression we will be able to remain ourselves. We will be able to speak Russian, our native language, with which we were born and studied. We will have the right to relate to the history and results of the Great Patriotic War without manipulation. Our grandfathers and great-grandfathers can be considered the winners against fascism and in no other way. Thanks to Russia's special operation, joy and hope for a just future appeared in the Donbas.
The ultimate goal of our republic is to hold a referendum in which the people exercise their constitutional right and express their opinion on joining the Russian Federation. I'm sure that's exactly what will happen. The vast majority of the inhabitants of the Luhansk Republic have been living for 8 years under constant shelling and being in an economic and political blockade, experiencing the mockery and horrors of the Nazi battalions of Ukraine. They felt support only from the Russian Federation. With hope and a dream in our hearts, we are waiting for the opportunity to become part of the Russian Federation, to return, as they said in the Crimea, to our native harbour and start working on a great future.
The emotional answer of the head of the LPR to be about holding a referendum on joining Russia caused a wide response. Later he explained that the main task facing the leadership of the LPR now is the completion of hostilities. According to him, the battalions of Ukrainian nationalists are responsible for the murder, torture, robbery and rape of civilians in Donbas. Most of them are relied on the experience of the commanders of the SS division during the World War II, and here in the settlement of Trehozbenka, still terrified, people did not believe in liberation and whispered about how they were bullied and subjected to violence. Here, the LPR servicemen found torture chambers with Nazi symbols hung up and the remains of those who simply disappeared from the village one day without a trace. The documents and an armaments depot were left by terrorist organization Right Sector. The LDPR military and people's militia say they collected documents about cases of cruelty against the population of Donbas and people from other regions of Ukraine. The documents include photos of people killed by bombing, runic symbols and signs of national battalions, facts of war crimes against humanity, and the positions of battalions in settlements with caches of weapons of mass destruction. When the Russian forces entered their town, Ukrainian battalions left all the civilian property destroyed. Residents of the city were forbidden to evacuate, and looting had begun. In Lugansk, servicemen showed tanks and heavy weapons left by Ukrainian militants in the liberated cities and towns. All captured grenade launchers and ammunition, armored personnel carriers, tanks and grenade launchers are productions of the UK, US, Turkey and NATO countries. Donbas leaders and citizens emphasize that the ongoing military operation of Russia was only a response to the criminal acts of Kyiv against Donbas as a timely and preemptive measure. Today, Moscow says it has documents with proof that Kyiv was preparing a large-scale attack and intended to destroy the DNR and LNR.
Russia says its aim over the past months has been to target Ukrainian military infrastructure to prevent the enemy from regrouping and reinforcing its presence in the Donbas. It says it will press ahead with a strategy until the whole region is liberated. Marina Kartunova, Lugansk region.
Resistance movements are heaping their praises on a young Palestinian man who lost his life after killing several Israelis in an operation near Tel Aviv as part of the struggle against the occupation. Hamas says the attack was a heroic operation in response to the crimes and acts of terror committed by the Israeli regime, and the Islamic Jihad has described it as the price the Israeli regime must pay for its brutalities and terrorist acts. Meanwhile, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine has pointed to the operation as proof of a collective Palestinian commitment to resistance. The Al-Aqsa Brigades has also reacted by calling the attack a natural response to Israeli crimes. The 26-year-old Palestinian shot and killed at least five Israelis, including a military officer, in the suburbs of Tel Aviv and was fatally shot by Israeli forces late on Tuesday. Just ahead of a meeting of Afghan neighbors hosted by China, Iran's foreign minister says Afghanistan deserves more attention from the international community. Hossein Amir Abdullahian says Tehran and Beijing support independence, national unity, and the rights of the Afghan people. According to the minister, Iran and China are hoping to see a stable and developed Afghanistan that interacts with its neighbors. Amir Abdullahian is set to meet with his counterparts from Russia, Indonesia, Turkmenistan on Pakistan, as well as the Uzbek foreign minister and prime minister during his visit to China. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi will host the third foreign minister's meeting of Afghanistan's neighboring countries in Tunxi in the eastern Anhui province. Andrew K.P. Leong, independent China specialist, joins us via Skype out of Hong Kong. Thank you very much, Andrew, for giving us your time again today. Tell me your understanding of this. Let's just start by the role China can play and the help these countries, neighboring countries, can give to Afghanistan through meetings as such.
Well, China's always opposed the principle of non-interference in other countries and also opposes kind of unilateralism. It always opposed the world view, a more holistic view, where countries even at odds do not need to come to blows. And as far as Iran is concerned, Iran and China is concerned, the relationships between the two countries date back centuries ago to the time of Persia and China's Tang Dynasty, you know, thousands of years ago. And so the two civilizations, they were both ancient civilizations, see eye to eye on a number of things, particularly in the stability of the Eurasian continent. Because Afghanistan sits at the kind of gateway between China and the rest of Eurasia and Europe. And of course, the stability in the region is very important, even though, for example, Iran and also the Arab countries and also Arabic influence, for example, in Afghanistan, the Taliban, they do not need to come to blows. I mean, it is, as I said, as in the case of over Ukraine, it is always possible to broker for peace and stability. But that doesn't mean countries do not need to vie with one another or to compete with one another, but they can compete on more equal footing and also in a peaceful environment. So I think that stability in Afghanistan is also important both for Iran in that region as well as China, because it sits at the right at the gateway of China's Belt and Road to Eurasia and the rest of Europe. Plus the fact that Afghanistan is very rich in resources, lots of minerals and so on and so forth, which remain untapped. And these kind of resources are very important for the livelihood of the Afghan people as well, apart from of strategic importance to China. So that's why China supports this kind of role and a kind of rapport between the various key players, China and also Iran.
Thank you very, very much, Andrew K.P. Leong, independent China specialist out of Hong Kong. Iran's deputy UN ambassador says Washington's inhumane unilateral sanctions against the Islamic Republic keep seriously threatening the Iranian people's health. In an address to the UN General Assembly, Zahra Irshadi said the coercive measures by the U.S. and its allies make it harder for coronavirus-stricken nations to battle the pandemic. She said the White House claims the sanctions do not hamper Iranian imports of foodstuff and medicine, but actually the banking restrictions make Iran's purchases impossible. Irshadi also said, despite the sanctions, Iran's made great progress in the medical field and is now one of the few countries producing the COVID-19 vaccine.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
the supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick, and healed, and made well, and afflicted, and sat upon the throne, and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Nowruz in Travelogues. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are with you with another episode of Nowruz special series. Nowruz has impacted foreign travelers and tourists so deeply that many of them have put accounts on what they had seen in Iran during this ancient feast. Traditions, customs, rituals, and arts comprised a very important part of every nation's culture and special heritage. They, in fact, shape the identity of every nation. The vast land of Iran has a long history and ancient civilization with a variegated geography. In view of this, it has attracted millions of tourists from across the world. Many of these tourists and even merchants have registered their experiences in Iran in the form of books or written and illustrated reports. Although some of these reports and accounts reflect the travelers' subjective ideas, they show a lot of realities. Clearly, Iran has been the focus of colonialist powers because of its geostrategic situation. For instance, During the Qajarid rule in Iran, particularly during the reign of Nasiruddin Shah, many foreign ambassadors traveled to Iran with political and economic purposes. As usual, Britain was the pioneer and dispatched many agents under various titles to spy for the Queen and the British colonial government. These agents scrutinized in every aspect of the Iranian nation to gain the best concessions from the Iranian government. A brief look at these accounts and reports indicates how much the Nowruz traditions and customs have changed during centuries. Nearly none of these travelogues refers to the nature, history, and status of Nowruz among Iranians. They just give what the traveler or politician has observed during his stay in Iran. Thus, some of their accounts include Nowruz customs mainly among countries rather than laymen. Greek historian of the 5th century BC, Herodotus, has touched upon some of the behaviors of Iranian kings like Cyrus the Great, Darius, Xerxes, and so on. He has also pointed to the customs of Iranians in various occasions. He writes, in Nowruz, in Iran at the time of the New Year, the Achaemenid king in his palace with closed doors would wake up before morning and wait. When the sun would spread her first rays, someone would knock at the door and the king would ask, "Who is there?" He would hear, "Open the door, please. I am the representative of Ahura Mazda and I have brought the new year." At this moment, the door would open and a young, handsome man would enter, followed by another young man. The latter carried cereals, grains, wheat, barley, and rice in silver cups, and also gold coins to offer to the king. The king would eat from the foods, indicating the divine amplitude and subsistence, and would take from the coins as the sign of wealth and prosperity. Then the doors of palace would open for people, and people would meet their king. They would congratulate the king, receive gold coin, and talk to the king on their hardships and problems. This ritual continued for 6 days, and then the doors of palace would be closed again. Garcia da Silva Figueroa, Spanish traveler who had a trip to Iran during the reign of the Safavid king Shah Abbas, writes on Nowruz, "It is the Nowruz Eve and the king has invited all members of the camp for porridge and rice and has given everyone 10 coins as gift. The attendees held a copper or bronze dish, which they would fill with water and sprinkle it to others. Sometimes they would throw the full dish to one another, hence breaking the heads of many of them and killing some others instantly." Russian merchant Fedot Afanasyevich Katov, who had come to Iran in 1624, writes in his memoirs, "People in Nowruz would break red eggs and kiss one another. They would spread carpets in rooms and gardens and put expensive items on them. Everyone covers their shops with plaster and decorate them with flowers. In the morning, all shops and houses light candles and small lamps and adorn them with flowers. Businesses were closed in these days and there were only games and different performances at squares. At the enclosure of the palace, a few people would wrestle to entertain the guests. Acrobats, clowns, and jugglers would play their arts, and at times, there was the bullfight or sheep fight. French tourist of the 17th century, Jean-Pierre Chardin, also writes in his travelogue on Nowruz customs in Iran. Iranians, reminding their ancient traditions, would gift painted eggs to each other on the eve of Nowruz. Iranians believe that the egg is the source of generation, life, and creatures. The king gifted some 500 eggs to his wives. The eggs were in a closed golden box and decorated with 4 miniature drawings. The king sat at the table among the royal women who were plunged in jewels, and they conversed warmly. Then musicians and singers entered upon the king's order and entertained the attendees. In another room, the court astronomer was trying to estimate the exact moment of the start of the year. As soon as he gave the news of the turn of the year, firecrackers were set off and court maidens cried out of joy. At that moment, the guards of palace declared the news with gun and cannon shots. A group was also beating drums and long-necked horns. Chardin then writes on Nowruz among ordinary people. Iranians look at water at the time of the turn of the year. This means that water brings light and it will make the individual happy till the end of the year. A few verses of the Quran are recited and everyone drink water and rose water in new clothes. They congratulate the elderly relatives and friends and distribute sweets. They also give alms among the poor and descendants of the Prophet. Dinner has been prepared at homes and everyone exchange gifts and visits. This French tourist also writes that Iranians cover jars with fresh green sprouts, which are delightful to the viewer.
On behalf of myself and all of my colleagues here at Arabi English Radio, we wish you a wonderful Nowruz, full of happiness and prosperity.
General Qasem Soleimani was an Iranian general who headed the Quds Force, a branch of the Iranian Revolution Guard Corps, the IRGC. Meanwhile, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, an Iraqi, headed Kata'ib Hezbollah and was the deputy commander of the Hashd al-Sha'bi, known in English as the Popular Mobilization Units, or PMU. Both these men played a significant role in defeating al-Qaeda and ISIS, or Daesh, in Syria and Iraq. They formed an integral part of the axis of resistance and were instrumental in Iran's larger support for resistance movements in West Asia, including the Palestinian resistance and Hezbollah. I wanted to ask the following questions. What did the work carried out by Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis mean for the region? How have things changed since their murder? And did the Americans succeed in their goal of weakening the axis of resistance? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. On January 3rd, 2020, a commercial flight arriving from Damascus landed in Baghdad airport. Aboard the plane was General Qasem Soleimani, who had come on an official visit at the invitation of the then Iraqi Prime Minister. General Soleimani was met by Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Meanwhile, circling overhead were a number of American aircraft. As Soleimani's convoy was leaving the airport, a Reaper drone fired on them, killing Soleimani and Abu Mahdi, along with four members of the IRGC and four members of the PMU. The shock of this incident was immediately apparent. Chris Murphy, a Democratic senator from Connecticut, described Trump's assassination of Soleimani as the equivalent of the Iranians killing the U.S. Defense Secretary.
As to how to manage the fallout that comes from such a drastic action. This is the equivalent of the Iranians assassinating the U.S. Secretary of Defense. If the Iranians were to assassinate the U.S. Secretary of Defense, we would consider that an act of war, and we would respond disproportionately.
Trump knew full well that Iran would respond. How could they not? After all, Soleimani was one of the most important and powerful men in Iran, if not the entire region. The day after the assassination, Trump went on an all-caps tirade on Twitter, saying that if Iran responded, they would be hit, quote, very fast and very hard. He also threatened to bomb Iran's cultural sites, a war crime under international law. No U.S. president before Trump had dared to kill General Soleimani, knowing full well that it would be unjustifiable and could easily lead to war. Soleimani's body was brought to Iran to begin the funeral processions and national mourning. In multiple cities, literally millions of people flocked to the streets to mourn the slain commander. Just take a look at these clips from the funeral processions. General Qasem Soleimani was buried on January 7th in his hometown Kerman, after his burial had to be postponed twice because of how large the crowds were, a testament to his popularity. On January 8th, Iran began Operation Martyr Soleimani. In response to the assassination, Iran sent a barrage of rockets, firing a dozen ballistic missiles at the Ayn al-Assad airbase in Iraq. This base housed foreign troops, mainly Americans, and is located in Iraq, west of Baghdad. This volley of rockets leveled the base. There were no fatalities, however, it said that scores of U.S. troops were injured, many diagnosed with traumatic brain injuries. Now, the framing of this attack is again very funny, because in the mainstream media, they were asking if Iran was ready to de-escalate the situation, as if Iran had just assassinated a U.S. official. And also saying things like, well, Iran is lucky. They're lucky they didn't kill any U.S. troops when they launched those missiles. Otherwise, we would have responded. Well, no, Iran didn't just randomly decide to launch missiles at the Ayn al-Assad airbase for no reason or because they don't like your clothes or your hair. They launched the missiles at Ayn al-Assad because you just committed an act of war and murdered an Iranian government official. It is, in fact, the United States who's lucky that Iran didn't do more. Now, the legality of such a strike has been at the center of debate about Soleimani's killing. Donald Trump claimed that Soleimani was planning an imminent attack against Americans. Then-Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that killing Soleimani, quote, saved American lives.
It's the right decision. We got it right. The Department of Defense did excellent work. And the president had a entirely legal, appropriate, and a basis, as well as a decision that fit perfectly within our strategy.
It's probably a good time to mention that Mike Pompeo was also the former director of the CIA, where he also did this.
I was the CIA director. We lied, we cheated, we stole. It's like we had entire training courses.
Neither Trump nor Pompeo could provide any evidence to substantiate their claims about Soleimani. At first, they said that there was an imminent threat, but couldn't give a timeline when. They said days or weeks. Then Pompeo said that they had killed Soleimani because of something that happened in the days before the strike. But those are two completely different things. Something cannot be imminent if it's in the past. And it's not hard to see that Pompeo and Trump are lying and had no evidence of any so-called imminent threat. It seems the only reason Trump and Pompeo made this ridiculous claim about self-defense is because it's the only way Trump could legally justify the assassination at home under U.S. law. In 1973, the War Powers Resolution was passed, requiring the president to notify Congress within 48 hours of taking military action. In the Trump administration's legal rationale for assassinating Soleimani, they cited the authorization for the use of military force of 2002, also known as the AUMF of 2002, which was passed under the Bush presidency for the invasion of Iraq in 2003. This is one of the most extreme, exaggerated interpretations of the AUMF 2002, which, by the way, was authorized against Iraq, not Iran. And nevertheless, that's just U.S. law, not international law. So just because Trump cites the AUMF of 2002, that doesn't suddenly make it okay on the world stage. Remember, the invasion of Iraq in 2003 was a war of aggression and is considered illegal under international law. Trump also claimed that, quote, "The strike against Soleimani in Iraq was taken in the United States' national self-defense, as recognized in Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, in response to a series of escalating armed attacks that Iran and Iran-supported militias had already conducted against the United States." Well, speaking of the United Nations disagrees. Agnès Callamard is the UN Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial, summary, and arbitrary killings. She concluded the U.S. murder of General Soleimani to be unlawful and illegal under international law. In July 2020, the Special Rapporteur published a report in which she examined the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. She rejected the United States' attempts to justify his murder. She found the U.S. to be in violation of the U.N. Charter and that, quote, "the course of action taken by the U.S. was unlawful." Article 2.4 of the UN Charter forbids the use of force by one UN member state against another. She concluded that the United States broke this law. The examples of imminent threats provided by the US were in fact not imminent, but things that had already happened months before. Some of them were not even actual attacks, but rather perceived threats, while other examples included things like Iran shooting down a US drone that had illegally entered Iranian airspace. Sina Rahmani is a translator, scholar, and writer. His work has appeared in Iranian Studies, Radical History Review, and Public Books, among others. He's also the creator of The East is a podcast that takes a critical look at the history of the present in West Asia and North Africa. I asked him what he thought the motivations were behind the United States assassination of General Soleimani.
So two men represented and were, in addition to their own work as military commanders, effective ambassadors for their cause and their alliances, movers in their own political environments, and sort of the military aspect, and those aspects of their personality, they both were symbols of a resistance to the U.S. imperial agenda in the region that's been unfolding for three decades in different ways and in different backdrops. But they were the symbol of an alliance between certain forces in the region. They named themselves the Axis of Resistance. But whatever name you give to themselves, it's really just a anti-colonial sort of resistance front or anti-imperial resistance front. So that's the kind of general answer. But in reality, I think there are the sort of cold political calculations. I think that at the time we were in the midst of this kind of unfolding crisis, generated essentially at the behest of a highly placed sorts of individuals who more or less purchased foreign policy. And that was the sort of signature effect of the Trump presidency, is that he was honest in a way. The Saudis and certain factions among Zionists sort of hedged their bets and they invested in this guy. And that paid off in that unfolding crisis in those 2 years. And this was, I don't want to say culmination, but in effect, the most dramatic sort of theater of that unfolding drama that was ultimately begun by Washington, begun in those sort of like secret, you know, and unfolded over the course of those 2 years and resulted in the assassination of these two men. Extrajudicial killing, you know. It was totally illegal, and I mean, that's obvious.
I mean, we mentioned these cold, calculated foreign policy decisions. On that front, what was the goal? Why were the Americans trying to assassinate Soleimani and Abu Mahdi in terms of foreign policy objectives? And did they succeed? You know, if their goal was to change the Middle East, do you believe that they succeeded in that? And how do you think their deaths have affected the region?
In the sense of, like, you know, cold, hard calculations, nothing changes. I mean, nothing changes in the real... There are these two men played historic roles, yes, but ultimately they were reflections of a system of resistance that's been in production for a long time. And those systems had been tested in the last two decades of cataclysmic war being waged from all corners of the entire sort of West Asian region. And the Iranians emerged. There's a historic development in the last two decades. You know, this has been my adult life, is watching the U.S. empire make this insane, you know, like cataclysmic leap, you know, of ridiculous proportions, of it's trying to establish its like, you know, insane goals of regime change. You know, what was it, 7 countries in 5 years or 5 countries in 7 years? The General Wesley Clark thing. This is one chapter in a larger story of unceasing war fought by the U.S. against Iran, against its allies, and against anyone who doesn't want to go about being, you know, taking its place in the supply chain, which is what it wants from ultimately the entire region, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, basically the resistance goes on because it's a whole system of, countering colonialism, imperialism.
I mean, at a certain point, 40% of the U.S. military was surrounding Iran. I mean, think of that. That was the first phase. And then the second phase came, their mercenaries for the, you know, which their first class one was ISIS, and then the rest of their allies, their supposed allies. And it was just like this team that rocked up and spent the last 10 years destroying the countries that they hadn't destroyed. And the response to that was what Qasem Soleimani's legacy. And we undercut the value of Abu Mohandas, right? We should obviously sort of talk about that. But like both of these men and the forces that they represented and the alliances they represented and what they were, you know, leading members of, but ultimately were part of a larger sort of organism, that represented something historic. That's on the scale of the Spanish Civil War, where you had this fascist transnational alliance, except it was bigger than one country. And the response to it was a popular mobilization of normal people taking up weapons. And that's the legacy of the Hashd al-Sha'abi in the popular mobilization units, which were not a creation of Iran. It was, in fact, a creation of Iraqi Grand Ayatollah, right? That was Ali Sistani. So there's a lot of silliness when it comes to talking about Iran. And one of the worst things is this totally racist and totally bankrupt Orientalist thing of Iranians are the only ones who control things and the rest are their puppets. I mean, it's like Cold War stuff reinvented.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities.
So we know the excuses provided by the U.S. are not true. The United Nations and a large part of the world reject them. So why did the United States assassinate General Soleimani? The murder of Haj Qasem was part of a string of American hostilities against Iran. Trump quit the nuclear deal in 2018. Then he reimposed sanctions on Iran, crippling its economy, flying drones and bombers into Iranian airspace. Trump and Pompeo claimed that Soleimani endangered American lives. No, he didn't. America endangered its own troops' lives, never mind the people of Iraq, Syria, and others, by invading countries on the other side of the planet. This is not your turf. No one endangers American lives in the Middle East except America. You cannot invade foreign countries and then expect people to just shut up and tolerate being occupied. It's also quite amusing listening to the Western media try to explain who Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas was. They say that he fought against American interests in Iraq, as if the Americans have any business being there in the first place after they invaded and occupied the country. That's like if you're talking about the French resistance in World War II and you say that the French resistance is opposing German interests in France. That's a very funny way to say that someone is resisting a foreign military occupation. Now, the United States claims that Soleimani was a terrorist. But Soleimani was killing terrorists, specifically the ones in Syria, funded and supported by the United States, Israel, and their allies. Soleimani's role in the region was an undeniably important one. Most generals today, whether in Iran or the United States, are unheard of. Most Americans probably have no idea who General Petraeus is, and he's one of the more known military leaders in the U.S. In Iran, with General Soleimani, it's a completely different story. He's a national hero and was known as being charismatic and a general who led from the battlefield, not a desk general who sat comfortably away from the front. The Americans love to pretend that they care about minorities. They pretend to care for the Christians in Iraq and Syria. When Mike Pompeo spoke in Occupy Jerusalem, he claimed that General Soleimani was responsible for killing thousands of Christians across the Middle East. This is one of the biggest lies that has ever come out of Mike Pompeo's mouth, which is really saying something.
Qasem Soleimani. This is the man most responsible for the murder and maiming of hundreds of American soldiers and thousands of Christians across the Middle East.
Neither Soleimani nor Iran has ever killed or targeted Christians in the Middle East. On the contrary, Christians who come from the Middle East, like myself, owe a huge debt of gratitude to General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi, because these men and their troops are the ones who protected Christians from being killed by Daesh. Meanwhile, it is the United States and Israel and people like Mike Pompeo who were funding Daesh and Jabhat al-Nusra and terrorist groups like that, which purposely targeted religious minorities. This is why when Haj Qasem was assassinated, Arab churches in the region held mass for Soleimani and Christians prayed for him. Soleimani is not only dear to the Iranians, but to all the people of West Asia and the Levant who understood the role that he played in fighting the imperialists and their proxies in the region. Dr. Fuad Izadi is an associate professor of American studies at the University of Tehran. His work focuses on United States-Iran relations and U.S. public diplomacy. Izadi has also appeared as a political commentator on various international media outlets such as RT, Sky News, and Al Jazeera. I asked him about the important work General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi carried out in protecting minorities in the Middle East. Well, one thing that isn't really talked about enough is that Haj Qasem, Abu Mahdi, they really helped to protect minorities in the Middle East. Christians, Muslims, you know, everyone alike realized the important role that they played. Even after his death, after Soleimani's death, we saw Christians holding mass for him in churches, praying for Haj Qasem. I mean, isn't that a powerful example, a powerful testament to his defense of all kinds of ethnic groups and religions living in this region, defending them from terrorism and imperialism?
You know, this is something that the Western corporate media has generally censored, the fact that Christians in Syria, the Christians in Iraq, were under attack by ISIS unjustly. Islam does not teach its followers to kill Christians. That's not part of Islamic teaching. And realizing that fact, it was actually Qasem Soleimani that was defending the Syrian people and the Iraqi people, no matter what the religion was. And it was very much true, as you said, that after his assassination, Christians in this part of the world lost someone who was helping them survive attacks by people who claimed to be Muslim, but they were not really following the teachings of Islam. And this very fact is hardly see any coverage of that very fact, because Qasem Soleimani was supposed to be a terrorist. You cannot have a terrorist defending Christians. That's not going to be the frame that Western news media outlets want to present. So there's a lot of hypocrisy when it comes to how the media coverage in this part of the world is actually done. It was Qasem Soleimani that highlighted this hypocrisy throughout his life.
You know, one of the things the United States likes to take credit for is supposedly defeating Daesh. Even until now, they claim that they're in Iraq because they're fighting Daesh. Realistically speaking, does the credit go to the Americans or does it go to Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis? Because a lot of people seem to think that they should take the credit for helping to bring the downfall of Daesh. Do you agree that they had a much more significant role in combating all these foreign fighters, the terrorist groups backed by NATO and the Arab countries in the Persian Gulf?
Who was fighting terrorism? Qasem Soleimani, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in Iraq. We have numerous accounts of the U.S. actually helping ISIS directly or indirectly. So this is something that even some Western sources wrote after the assassination of Qasem Soleimani, that the United States assassinated the most important individual in the fight against ISIS. The U.S. talked about fighting ISIS in a lot of cases. They actually helped ISIS. The country that fought ISIS, the military commander that engaged in that was Qasem Soleimani. So that's, if somebody's interested in fighting terrorism, somebody's interested in establishing peace, they should look at Qasem Soleimani as a hero.
So in the last weeks, we've seen reports that the Israelis were involved in the attack, or at least they've admitted to being involved in the attack. Trump allegedly said that he felt used by the Israelis. What do you think of that? Do you agree with that assessment that the Israelis used him? And what do you make of the Israeli role in the murder of Haj Qasem and Abu Mahdi?
But, you know, we had a retired Israeli general that just a few days ago said that Israel is very involved. And we had other accounts that actually pointed out that Qasem Soleimani was someone that not only fought against U.S. domination. And overall, you have a situation where Israelis are not actually in a better shape today when you compare their standing now to what happened to when Qasem Soleimani was alive. You remember just a few months ago, we had the resistance in Gaza, in Palestine, actually fighting back.
In the Middle East, General Soleimani is considered a hero because he defeated terrorists like Daesh and Al-Qaeda. In the West, they call him a terrorist because he defeated their proxies, Daesh and Al-Qaeda. If the goal of the assassination was to cripple Iran or hurt Iran's military capabilities, that has obviously failed. Iran is stronger than it was 2 years ago by all reasonable metrics. Look how its military capability has grown and how the regional makeup has shifted in its favor. The United States had to flee Afghanistan. It can no longer sustain its occupation of Iraq. Its war against Syria has failed. If the goal was to demoralize the axis of resistance, that has also failed. The Houthis in Yemen are making huge advances as Saudi Arabia realizes it can no longer sustain this war against them. In Iraq, Soleimani's assassination prompted the Iraqi parliament to vote to tell the Americans to leave. And the Hashd al-Shaabi have become an even stronger force in Iraq, keeping the U.S. occupation on its toes. And while sanctions in Syria continue to take a strong toll, the project for regime change has failed and looks weaker and weaker by the day as Arab countries begin normalizing ties again with Syria. In Lebanon, Hezbollah has brought in fuel and helped to mitigate the effects of the de facto American siege with the help of Iran. And finally, Iran itself is in an even stronger position than it was before. It has more leverage in its nuclear program, a stronger relationship with China and Russia, and deeper ties with its neighboring countries. So by killing Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, did the United States succeed in weakening Iran or weakening the axis of resistance? The answer is clearly no. Iran and the resistance axis, they don't function like the USA or some random country. You cannot just kill one man, one leader, and then think, oh, everything is over. Now, while General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi were certainly formidable tacticians and commanders in their own right, together they formed part of a system, part of the resistance. And you cannot defeat the resistance by simply killing one or two important individuals. Haj Qasem and Abu Mahdi played a crucial role. This is undeniable. But the objectives of resisting against occupation, imperialism, and neocolonialism continue. And this is something that will only end with the complete liberation of the Middle East and Palestine. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
The Limelight. Last week, Eurostat, the European Union Statistical Agency, released a revised estimate of the euro area's February inflation rate. It wasn't a happy report. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times opinion columnist Paul Krugman. The piece is titled America's Economy in the European Mirror. Last week, Eurostat, the European Union statistical agency, released a revised estimate of the euro area's February inflation rate. It wasn't a happy report. Consumer prices were up 5.9% from a year earlier, more than most analysts had expected. And it's going to get worse as the effects of the conflict in Ukraine weigh on food and energy prices. Britain hasn't yet released its February inflation number, but the Bank of England expects it to match the rate in the euro area. Of course, US inflation is even higher, with February consumer prices up 7.9% from a year earlier. These numbers aren't exactly comparable for technical reasons, but inflation in the United States does seem to be running around 2 percentage points higher than in Europe. I'll come back to the difference and what might explain it. But surely the fact that inflation is up a lot in many countries, not just America, is worth noting. After all, the entire Republican Party and a fair number of conservative Democrats insist that the recent surge in US inflation was caused by President Biden's big spending policies. Europe, however, had nothing comparable to President Biden's American Rescue Plan. Last year, the euro area structural budget deficit, a standard measure of fiscal stimulus, was only about a third as large as a percentage of gross domestic product as America's.